From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armenia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk pet peeves. You've been waiting for it. It's here. The first installment in our Pet Peeve-a-Palooza. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, of course, as they do each week, language experts and New York Times bestselling authors, Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Hello, Kathy. Hello, Ross. We, of course, for a while now have been asking everybody for their language pet peeves. And we've been dribbling them out here and there as time has gone on, but we decided to take the plunge and to jump into our giant lake of peeves and get going with what will probably end up being multiple episodes of language pet peeves.
Oh, yeah. I just want to say, because it's autumn, that as I said to Ross, instead of bringing in the sheaves, we're bringing in the peeves.
That's very good, Kat.
I was going to sing it too.
Although, I'm just going to say something quickly now. Do you know the definition of sheave or sheaves, Fletcher?
No. I was honestly just going to let that one pass on by. I almost said what are sheaves? But
It's a harvest thing.
Yeah, well, I figured
okay, Kathy,
maybe since
okay, Kathy, you actually, okay, Fletcher, stop for 1 second. Don't look it up, Kathy.
I'm not,
right now,
I can't.
You threw that word out. Now you, it is upon you, incumbent upon you to give us a definition of sheaf.
I thought a sheaf was when you took like a lump of, say, wheat and bound it into like a thing.
That's really good, Kath. It's a large bundle of grain.
Ha ha! That's because I'm such an agrarian type. You know me.
Yeah, very good, Kathy. I'm very impressed.
Wait a minute. So this is going to get me in big trouble with everybody around here. What's a shock?
Oh, a shock?
A shock is a pile of sheaves.
Well, I was being very... You're right. I'm just looking it up right now.
Here's why I ask, right? Is because... So I'm in Wichita, and Wichita State University, the... mascot, you may or may not know, people generally refer to as the Shockers. They're technically the Wheat Shockers because years and years ago, a lot of people around here would go and work in the wheat fields when they weren't in university. And so they were shocking the wheat.
That is so interesting.
So they were taking many sheaves
uh-huh.
and making a shock.
Yeah, a shock.
A pile of sheaves.
Which is not like shucking an oyster or a ear of corn.
No.
I'm actually going to look that one up as we speak. Shuck. This is like now we're going
Speaking of peeves, perhaps I shouldn't have had that extraordinarily bad open.
No, this is gotten us somewhere interesting. Okay.
Yeah, shuck basically is stripping an ear of corn.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also opening an oyster or a clam.
Yeah, it's
clams.
Also opening a husk pod or a shell. Unknown origin, though. And interestingly enough, Kathy, shucking an oyster is really recent, 1872.
Huh.
Well, here we go already. We didn't even begin, and we were diverting ourselves.
You know what? We're going to start getting letters now about their pet peeve will be, can you guys stick to the topic?
I know. We've gone from sheaves, shock, to shock. Okay. Okay, let's bring in the peeve now, which starts with a P in this case.
Okay, it's from Tim from New York City.
Hi, Tim.
He writes us a fair amount. Mm-hmm. This one intrigued us. He said, I'd like to add the use of paranoid to mean afraid or scared.
Mm.
This may be from the Californian dialect. And since I have a connection by marriage to California, I do too, Tim. Ah, so does Roz.
Yes.
I hear it a lot. Example, she's paranoid about being stuck in an elevator, or she's paranoid of riding in elevators. The worst is she's paranoid of elevators. I believe the use of paranoid here is what Fowler calls a popularized technicality, which seems to happen a lot with terms of psychology, cf. Manic and Oedipal. For me, however, it's, drumroll, an idiotized technicality.
Oh.
Go Tim. So that's his peeve.
I do have to say that is a wonderful example of a popularized technicality. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about a few others in a minute with quantum leaps to mind. But anyway, would you ever use that, Fletcher, or not? I would never have used that. I think I would. I've never used and never would use it.
Not, Kath, not in that same way. Yeah, not in that way. I think
I'm paranoid about.
Okay, not about something like that. But I have said that I'm paranoid, but not just to mean that I'm afraid of something or that I have a phobia. That not in that way. No.
I mean, you know, one thing is that definitions and word usages obviously drift and change with the times. Technically speaking, paranoia means mental derangement, and it comes from the ancient Greek para nous, which is para means beside and nous is mind. So you're basically going or beyond parakin means. You're going beyond the mind. You're going, you know, really full-fledged wacko. And then it came into English basically meaning, you know, someone who's feeling completely, they're delusional, and they're feeling that people are all after them, mm-hmm. various, or things are all after them. Mm-hmm. And obviously, when you're paranoid of elevators, you don't think the elevator's going to run up and snatch you or anything like that. So it is incorrect, technically, in terms of usage. The question is it accept? I mean, you know, like, who are we to say you can use a word which way or whatever? I mm-hmm. still hear paranoid. When I hear that, I kind of wince. I don't like the term. I know it's casual, and I don't think the person really means that they're screaming in the elevator, it's out to get me or anything. I don't think mm-hmm. that. They just don't like it. What do you all think about that?
This is a toughie, because I got to say, I initially was going to go, oh, yeah, God, paranoid, they use that way. Oof. But then I started thinking, when I hear paranoid about, I hate to say it, but I wouldn't be surprised if I have been guilty of saying something like that. Like, oh, yeah, I'm paranoid about trying free VPNs because you never know what's going to happen.
I'm thinking,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm thinking a little more about this, and I don't think I've said it exactly that way, but let's say every time I do a particular thing, I triple check it, and somebody's like, boy, you know, you already checked that 3 times. I can definitely hear myself saying something like, yeah, but I'm just paranoid about that.
You know something? You're right.
Yeah,
I could that,
see, that's what I'm thinking. I actually don't think I'm sorry, Tim, because Tim, you're being like much more correct than we. But I actually think I might say it.
Yeah, I don't know if I would. But that's Fletcher. When he said that, yeah, I'm just paranoid. I do the same thing you do, Fletcher. I triple check stuff mm-hmm, a lot of mm-hmm, times, mm-hmm. particularly after Kathy years ago with the IRS. Proudly, I hired someone to do our taxes. Kathy said, I do it all myself. And she did not triple check it. She deducted. Let me finish this. She deducted 100% of her apartment as her office, which, talk about a red flag. I mean, that was. She got an
I
audit.
I got a field audit, too.
I know. She
I
got an audit.
Come to my apartment.
I know. Oh my. But then we went to pay, and there was some problem. We went to the IRS office in downtown New York, and it was a huge office. There were hundreds of desks. I'll never forget this. Just hundreds. It was like a movie. And Kathy goes up, and they go, oh, this is irregular. This is going to be, you're going to have to get another audit or something like that.
And Kathy started. Wanted me to pay more. I started bawling.
She started bawling. I don't try to hurt the IRS like that. And I have to say, it was the most effective technique in the world.
Amazing.
Everyone panicked.
Oh, my goodness.
They whisked me to the back.
And here we go back. Here we go again with digressions. I'm sorry. We shouldn't have done this. I'm paranoid about doing these digressions. But, okay, so we're basically agreeing that, I mean, including rather reluctantly me, we're agreeing that basically paranoia, meaning systemized delusion, mental degenerations or whatever, which was the original definition when they picked it up in medical terms in the 1800s, now it's sort of gone beyond that. It can be used, or we do think many people use it casually, and we're not going to start wincing and yelling. Mm-hmm. Is that agreed, or?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes.
Sorry, I mean, sorry to Tim, but yeah, I don't think I would get bothered by this really at all.
Maybe yeah. Tim would prefer the Middle English term that used to be used. It was suspicious hood.
Ooh. I'm full of suspicious hood?
Yeah.
I don't care for that.
No?
It would be suspicious no. head in Middle English, but it'd be translated as suspicious hood.
Because how would you use that in a sentence?
Well, I think basically the patient has suspicious hood.
But that doesn't sound right, because you don't say the patient has brotherhood or the patient
it
has.
It doesn't sound right now, but if we were speaking Middle English.
Ah, yes. I don't know. I think the one thing I don't like, it's easier for me because of, you know, Latin and Greek, but it seems to me that in many cases they were really wrong to do all these Latin and Greek terms, because paranoia, in a way, you know, we don't really hear beyond the mind. We just hear the word paranoia. Mm-hmm. Suspicioushood, mm-hmm. we instantly understand what the medical condition is.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
It's much clearer. I mean, we go back to, like, you know, like the problem with adding all the Latin and Greek and stuff was making it, unless you know that stuff, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Well, moving along with no digression, Tim was really good with his popularized technicalities, and we have our own pet peeve.
Well, no, first I wanted to say, well, we found the other paranoids that I don't think sound bad.
Ooh.
For examples of his paranoid, and we had like a Samsung product forum. Someone was saying, I'm paranoid of trade-ins now.
Mm.
Someone else was talking about a mother's message board. She was talking about, she was worried about the kids. They didn't like the playpen. She said, but I'm paranoid of giving them negative vibes about their sleeping arrangements. And these, to me, didn't seem that bad, actually. We go back to.
Yeah, it kind of works, because if you just said afraid, it doesn't get the exact same idea across.
No. I'm paranoid about losing my phone to pickpockets. Where do you guys keep it?
Oh, wait a minute, though. I'm afraid of losing my phone because of pickpockets. Now I'm afraid of trade-ins. I'm afraid of giving them negative vibes about their sleeping arrangements.
Afraid doesn't mean as soon as the idea pops into my head, I'm like, ah. You know?
Yeah.
Like this is a thing that really, you know, sets you on edge right away.
So our definition of paranoid in common usage is what you just said, Fletcher. It's more than afraid.
Well, it's something that you're going to think about every single time.
That you do that thing.
Yeah. And you're going to be afraid every single time.
I mean, and to me, there's a layover of worry up top of it, too, because like, I'm paranoid about losing this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's like you're thinking when I do it, crap, am I going to lose it? Am I going to lose it? Am I going to lose it?
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
It's more more obsessive, maybe?
So it has a tinge of the medical in it still.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Now we're going to take a quantum leap into another popularized technicality. And can you guess what that word is, Fletcher?
Can we talk about this term, popularized technicality? This term means like a technical term from like a specific field that maybe has become popularly used. And maybe the meaning has changed a bit as it's become popularly used.
That last part is the interesting part for us, a la Tim's question. But yes, I mean, technically, a popularized technicality is just this specialized term that theoretically only a technician or someone in the field would understand.
Okay.
But that has entered our normal language.
Okay.
Often now when that enters, it becomes either vaguer or it does change meaning.
Yeah.
So then that's where we get into the concept, like the Fowler way of saying, like, it's something that once meant something specific in the field and now is often used in an incorrect or broadened manner.
And I guess that makes sense, because most of us don't have that technical knowledge that wherever it came from, those people would have. And so as it becomes more popularly used, the meaning very well could change, just because we don't have that same kind of knowledge. So we're going to use it in the way it makes sense to us, I guess.
But to be fair too, I mean, this happens with regular words as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we take a normal word, and we were talking about sheaves and stuff, and Kathy then, you know, put sheaves in the idiom, and we weren't thinking in that sense of it. We understood the idiom. We weren't even that sure what sheaves meant in
right.
a way.
Yeah.
And that happens often as well. I mean, words are constantly changing in language.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times people, including us, get like, oh my gosh, this is terrible. But it just happens.
Yeah.
And it's hard to really control, and it shouldn't probably be controlled. Although some of them, at least as snapshots of time, are annoying. And I think for Kathy and me, quantum leap is really annoying. I can't, that one always bothers me.
Yeah. Well, although in fairness, okay, what, do you know what a quantum leap is, Fletcher?
No. I know that Quantum Leap was my favorite show when I was like 11 or 12 years old, whenever that was on. So unless it's about time traveling into other people's bodies, I don't exactly know
what
a quantum leap
definition
is. Yes, it is. That's right. Putting right what once went wrong. Yeah, Thank you, Sam Beckett.
Oh, that was it. Yes.
Well, first of all, it used to be quantum jump. Oh. And it was coined in the mid-1900s in physics. Uh-huh. And what it literally does, it talks about a sudden change from one energy state to another within an atom. Now, we're talking about tiny, tiny changes. Uh-huh. I mean, tiny, tiny distances at this point.
Because quantum, when you're talking about the quantum world or whatever, you're talking about subatomic particles, like very, very even smaller than anything most of us have ever studied.
Yeah, well, quantum basically, it comes from the Latin, it just means amount,
right?
Really.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And yeah, we're talking about, and then the quantum jump or quantum leap is simply a change within the atom into a different state. The different state kind of like pulled out the meaning to make it different, because you're jumping from one state to another, which is small maybe in terms of the inside an atom, but it's kind of big in terms of, you know, like emphasis. This is a major difference.
Yeah, it kind of took off and became something different. I mean, like, I defy anyone who doesn't have technical knowledge of this to tell me what the word quantum means now. Mm. Look around you.
I agree with you.
It's everywhere and meaningless.
Yeah, no, when Ross and I wrote about this, because we found there was quantum healing, quantum computing, quantum mysticism, quantum sex, quantum job hunting, quantum coffee. It's like, unless you have a quantum of coffee, which would be my cup. You know what I mean?
Right.
But it's true. I think it's like one of those words that, like, he was talking about, Tim, that just caught on and everybody starts using it without really an idea of what they're saying.
Yeah.
When we talked about paranoid, we kind of generally agreed on a definition of paranoid that we could use as a, you know, as outside of the technical term. Mm-hmm. Quantum has like two things. I think quantum to us generally means now a quantum leap, for example, or a quantum jump means a big change. And I think we can agree on that. But then we get to things like quantum coffee and we have no idea.
Yeah.
That's where I think it does get silly.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's one of those cases where quantum really is just supposed to sound cutting edge.
That's it. Cool.
Just, you know, yeah. Who cares what quantum coffee is?
Yeah,
coffee is quantum.
It's quantum. Yeah.
You know? Shut up and drink it. You know? Take the oat milk. It's over there. It's free.
Although maybe we should change the show to Quantum Words.
Quantum Words. Oh, that's great.
The other one he had mentioned, which is one of my pet peeves, actually, and I'm with you on this one, Tim, is manic. I hate how manic is used now.
Yeah. So manic now is like something's really wild, really, really high energy, kind of bouncing off the walls. But we also don't use the term manic depressive anymore.
No.
No.
It's bipolar.
Now we use bipolar.
It's bipolar.
Although, interestingly enough, I'm sorry, bipolar came out in 1902, manic depression in 1903.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, okay, so what is your issue with how it's used?
My big issue is I just don't like it. The term I detest is manic pixie dream girl.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew it.
Thank you, Ross. I hate that. It sets my teeth on edge.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't like manic as that sort of quirky, like, you know, high energy, quirky.
Okay.
Like I'm wearing my cute little thrift shopped outfit and mom and dad are paying for my expensive apartment in Brooklyn. That manic is the one I hate.
Yeah, I guess I don't hear it used that way that much. It's much more chaotic, I think, when I hear somebody refer to something as manic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, I've heard it more as quirky.
Yeah.
So I think mine is a different manic that I've been hearing or that I'm addressing.
That's the TV trope or the movie trope or the film trope, that manic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I agree with Fletcher because I hear it more like, yeah, I'm just manic today. I have so much stuff to do and I'm trying to do everything, juggling it all up. That's what I sort of think of it as too.
Okay. So then I don't mind it that much. Okay.
Okay, let's move on to our next pet peeve. This is from Susie from Essex County, New Jersey.
Hi, Susie.
My biggest pet peeve currently is the sudden, nearly ubiquitous addition of go ahead and in conversation. Thank good I haven't seen it in writing. For example, I'm going to go ahead and process that refund for you now. Instead of I'm going to process that refund. Or I'll process that refund for you now. I've even heard people reduplicate like this. I'm going to go ahead and process that refund. I first noticed this completely unneeded address maybe 2 years ago, and now I hear it everywhere.
Oh, wow.
Much to my horror, have even caught myself saying it once or twice. Okay.
I don't think I've noticed it so much. It does sound like something someone would tell me if I called a helpline and they were taking care of something. And it also sounds a little bit condescending if that's the context. Like, I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to go ahead and take care of that. Or I'm going to go ahead and take this off your bill. You bothered me by calling me, but I'm going to go ahead and do it. Yeah, it seems like a customer service kind of interaction thing. I can't really think of somebody just saying that to me in conversation.
I think you're right. It tends to be, it's interesting because we did a little bit of research on this in linguistic forums as well. And it seems to be, oddly enough, it's popular use. It's not written. And it seems to be popularly used in sort of quasi-formal situations, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And one aspect was it can just add drama. think of this. They had this example here. I'm going to go put an offer on that house. Or, Fletcher, I'm going to go ahead and put an offer on that house. There's a little bit of a stress there. Mm-hmm. Wow, you're putting an offer on that house. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm.
And it is also, as you were saying, the thing with the helpline. It's a form of courtesy. It sounds like, I'm going to go ahead and do this for you. Yeah. I understand you said the condescending, but I actually don't know that it's as much condescending. It's like, I'm going to help you. I'm going to go ahead.
Yeah.
I don't think it's intentionally condescending. I definitely don't think it's intentionally condescending.
I'm going to throw in here, I had a problem a couple of months ago with a U.S. government agency that shall remain nameless. And I had sent in something and I think it was my social security number was wrong.
You can just say it was the Bureau of Land Management, wasn't it?
But I called them, here, get this catch 22. I called them up and they said, well, we can't, tell you, because I said, well, I have my real social security. They said, yeah, but it was transposed wrong. I said, but I didn't, because I had the, she goes, no, we must have done it in our office, but we can't help you unless you tell us the number that we mistransposed. I said, well, how can I know the number that you mistransposed? You did it. I didn't. They go, yeah, but we can't unlock your account unless you tell us the number that was wrong.
So they wanted you to give them the incorrect number.
But I couldn't give them the incorrect number because they made it incorrect. I didn't do it.
Yeah.
So how do I know what the incorrect number is? Oh. I said, you guys did. But they said, sir, the rules are this. So finally I call someone who I will remain nameless because nowadays who knows what will happen. So she goes, I'm going to go ahead. And I remember she said, go ahead. I'm going to go ahead and take a look at this again. And, I was thinking, a lot of times people look at twos and nines and they get them backwards. So then I, did it. Wow. And that go ahead, I remember specifically that go ahead.
It was like a signal to you.
It was a signal and it was a calming, she's going to save the day.
Yeah.
And she did.
Yeah.
So I agree with Kathy when she said that it's not necessary. I took it as a courtesy go ahead with emphasis and just wonderful, transcendent beauty or something like that.
Well, I'm glad that was a good experience for you. I'm going to go ahead and change my mind then on that phrase. I'm not, but
I'm trying to think. I don't know that. I don't think I've ever said it. I'm just trying to think. I'm going to go ahead and do this. I think I've always just said I'm going to do this.
I'm actually going to. I agree with you, Ken. I'm going to reverse what I just said to Fletcher. She used it the right way then, a way that was wonderful. But I don't really like the usage at all.
I think to
really
add
don't.
Drama. I think, like you said, to add drama. I may have done it like very consciously, knowing that I was adding that drama to it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and tell them what I think. Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead.
Yeah, I think that.
I'm just going to go ahead and move this cup over here. Right?
Yeah.
Somebody's in
your
space.
I think it's, I'm going to move the cup here now. Okay.
Well, but if you've come and you sat your cup right down in front of me and it smells like, I don't know, bad soup, And I'm like, I'm going to go ahead and move this over here. Right?
I like the imagery of bad soup smell or the smellery of it.
So we agree with Susie, though. This is
I think we all agree. I think we were explaining how you can use it, but we basically all agree that it's not a particularly good use it.
Yeah.
All right. I'm with you, Susie. We're all with you, Susie. Okay, now next is, it's similar, actually, which is why we put it in. It's also Tim. Tim again. Tim.
Oh, Tim.
Hi. Tim wrote, it was, the thing is that. The thing is, uh-huh. is that. And he said, I've seen this construction used with more complex subjects. Like, my reason for doing this is that.
Oh.
I'm tempted to ask the speaker to change the subject to plural. My reasons for doing this are that, to point out the absurdity. Why is okay, but not are? It's, my head is already exploding as I read this. My guess is that the original mistake derives from a mistaken version of what this is, which is correct because of the phrase what this is just the subject. So it needs a verb, while the thing is has a subject and a verb. Does that make sense? Take care, Tim in NYC. Tim, you made my head explode. So right now.
Also, I have to say with Tim, I mean, we're going to get into this in a couple seconds, or a couple minutes. But Tim actually explained one of the theories as to why this actually occurs. And the technical term is a pseudo-cleft sentence, which Tim brilliantly brought up in his letter to us. So I'm very impressed. We're all very impressed. Anyway. Let's talk about the double is construction.
If somebody's speaking, I don't think it bothers
me. Yes.
I don't think it really bothers me at all. If somebody's writing, I would probably notice it, and then I wouldn't care that much. Because I have definitely written the back-to-back is, although I think it's more like what Tim said, which is when you write what it is, or mm-hmm. whatever way he
but
said
it. But that's legit. Those are legit.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But I don't spend the time thinking, is this a legit version of is or is that, you know, like I'm used to the is at this point.
And it sounds okay. It's interesting, though, because I'm going to quote here from an English grammar book. One of the most robust and exceptionalist rules of English grammar is that there can be only one tense verb per clause. When an English speaker utters two tense verbs in succession, he is generally not speaking fluently. The second verb can be interpreted as a repair of the first. In other words, you're backtracking and say, oh, no, I meant this. And the first is a false start. There is one exception to this rule in the present tense. It seems when English speakers use is twice in a row, they are speaking perfectly fluently. The funny thing is that Fletcher was there, too. That is seen as perfectly correct, even though a lot of people annoy it. Yes.
Yeah.
But a lot of people... And such as Tim, they don't like it.
So that's correct, you're saying. So his pet peeve, my reason for doing this is that is correct.
Yeah, well, the argument is that it is seen now as correct, and it violates basically all rules of English with the two tense verbs in succession, is. But it is technically seen now as correct, and it's being used is, and they're actually... Even though generally it's used in the present tense, there's a case here I'm going to read to you right now. My feeling was that she doesn't have a professional hold on the situation. I think the is I can hear better, but I can understand it and it doesn't bother me as much. But they're saying it's sometimes a double, or here's this one. The funny thing is that we had no control over the situation. That's was is.
That one doesn't seem weird to me at all, though. That one sounds correct to my ear. The funny thing was that blah de blah.
Yeah, seems, I think you're right. It does. Okay,
that one seems right. Actually. I this one's like blowing my mind. I'm sorry, because I'm looking at Tim's thing. My reason for doing this is that, and that to me sounds wrong. I'm with Tim.
Well, it's interesting though, because this was not. It seems to be recent. A guy called McConnell in 1988 noticed it. And then, a guy, Dwight Bollinger, did in 1987, the remarkable double is. And then it became, people started studying it. One person found Charles Darwin wrote it
in the 1800s. That Darwin, yeah.
My excuse and reason is is the different way all the Wedgwoods view the subject from what you and my sister do. Darwin said it, but it came really, it seems to be a very recent phenomenon.
So now my question is do people do it like in their head? I'm looking at his example. My reason for doing this is that does the subject, when you're saying it, is my reason for doing this is becomes the subject, in effect?
Yes.
With the is,
yes. Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
And this is where Tim really brilliantly brought up what they call in linguistics WH pseudoclefs. And this is technically probably a WH pseudocleft construction. WH means what, why, when, where. So we have like Fletcher witnessed a murder, okay? Now what the person, when they're saying it is, they're saying what Fletcher witnessed is a murder. So then they take out the what Fletcher witnessed, and then they go, the thing is that. That's what they do. They take out the what. They think in their heads in a funny way of the what, and then they take the what out when they talk. Isn't that weird? The problem is that you're always late. That's the basic idea.
Problem is that you're
then
always
we go,
late.
What the problem is that you're always late.
Oh.
Then you take out the what, and then you have the problem is that,
that
you're always late.
Okay.
Isn't that cool?
Interesting.
That actually, okay, that makes it work for me. And I mean, I don't care for it, but I understand it makes it, because you're actually streamlining. Your brain is going like mm-hmm. out. Mm-hmm. Okay, here.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah.
Other people say that pseudocleft what thing is not true, it's just focus. But, I, you know, which is another linguistic term that everyone's big on now, like focus.
Yeah.
How you emphasize things.
Yeah.
But I think that the pseudocleft what is emphasizing
it. Why not both, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Although now this sentence that they have as an example, this is another one that makes my head explode. That can't be a very welcome outcome is that rates will now rise.
That's the focus argument.
Right. Kat. No, I know. I know that's the focus argument. And I look at that and I just go like, forget it. You know what I mean?
I think that's a great, forget it. I think Tim is right, though. I think he really caught on the, I think the basic thing is the what. And let's look at that sentence again, though. Let's put that in a WH pseudocleft construction here.
I'm going to give it to Fletcher, too, so he can
okay,
see it.
Okay, let's try to
if
do
I'm
it.
If I'm going to have an exploding head, he is, too.
Yeah, we're going to try to force this into a WH pseudocleft construction.
That can't be a very welcome outcome is that rates will now rise.
The focus is on the rates will now rise.
Uh-huh.
That's the focus marker.
But I don't understand what you can do with the...
What can't be a very welcome outcome is that rates will now rise.
Fletcher did it.
Yay, wow.
Okay.
Good job.
So we change the what to the that and then...
Yeah.
And they keep the is.
What can't be a very welcome outcome is that rates will now rise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it becomes that can't be a very welcome outcome is that rates will now rise, which sounds like nonsense, but isn't really if we... look at it the way you just mentioned, Ross.
But Fletcher, I think you are the WH pseudocleft king.
I'm going to get a plaque, maybe. I think.
We'll give you a plaque.
He needs a hat. Yeah.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petrus records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petrus from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. Our digital team is Beth Golay and Carly Cooper. Carly Cooper is also our video editor. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at krpetrus@gmail.com. You can also record a voice memo of yourself asking your question. You might get your voice heard on air. Or you can download the KMUW app and press the Talk to Us button. You can find Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.